Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is the last in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship in America. All of the programs in the series will be available through Fora TV after tonight and will be published as chapters in a book on social entrepreneurship by Stanford University Press, which hopefully will be out early next year. I hope all of you will buy at least 100 copies. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Matt Banik. As managing partner of Omidyar Network, Matt leads all aspects of its operations and strategies. When I was reading his career history, I thought, wow, this guy has had a really amazing life so far, at least professionally. He brings a wide range. Maybe we'll hear about the other stuff during the talk. I don't know. Or maybe that will prompt questions. Matt brings a wide range of executive, international, and multi-sector experience to this leadership role. From 1999 to 2007, he was a member of eBay's executive staff, and through his positions as president of international at eBay and then at PayPal, Matt was responsible for phenomenal growth, both in terms of global market share and of revenue. Additionally, Matt spearheaded eBay's initiatives in global development and citizenship, where he worked to bring the power of eBay to the developing world. Prior to joining eBay, Matt was a management consultant with McKinsey & Company and a foreign service officer in Germany at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall and German unification. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Washington and an MBA from Harvard Business School. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Matt Banik.
Thank you, Ruth, for that terrific introduction. And also thank you for all the fabulous work you've done in pulling together this really important and inspiring series on social entrepreneurship. I think you do a great service to the Commonwealth Club and the community here, so I think that's terrific and very much appreciated. And perhaps since it is the last, we should give you a bit of a round of applause to thank you for that.
Thank you. Okay, 99 books.
Well, no, the only thing I ask in return, Ruth, because I listen to this series on the radio, and I hear that gavel sound. Right. Maybe I can close up tonight. Maybe I can use that gavel and just kind of...
I don't know. You're bucking against 108 years of history. Let's see what I can do.
Okay. Well, I'll try and do a nice job and leave you no choice. So thank you again, and thank you, everybody in the audience. Ruth tells me this is one of the largest audiences she has had, and I really appreciate each of you taking the time this evening to spend an hour with us and to talk about kind of important issues in the realm of social entrepreneurship. So thank you very much, and I appreciate also that people were here in a very timely fashion. So, you know, we live in a world where technology and innovation are breaking down barriers and drawing the world closer like never before. Yet, at the same time, there are old divisions and rivalries rooted in static thinking and ideology that are inhibiting us from making the most of these historic opportunities. This is true in the world of philanthropy, where disagreement and confusion over the appropriate role of for-profit and not-for-profit enterprises is really constraining our ability to drive positive social change. This evening, I'd like to highlight how both business and not-for-profits offer valuable solutions. And indeed, when used in concert, they can be complementary tools for creating opportunity, innovation, and social progress, particularly for those who are less fortunate. Now, I'd like to start with a story about how Pierre Omidyar's experiences at eBay inspired him to embrace this sort of hybrid thinking in the first place. Now, as you emerge from the elevator at the offices of Omidyar Network, you're greeted by a quote painted in large letters on the wall that reads, "Every individual has the power to make a difference. This core belief is the cornerstone of our work. It comes from the experiences of our founder, Pierre Midiard, who is best known for starting the online marketplace, eBay. Now, the corporate history of eBay is well known, but an equally important story is what we learned about creating opportunity and positive social change in the process of building a thriving global enterprise. Pierre often remarks that if he had been asked to create 1 million jobs with a nonprofit or a governmental organization, he wouldn't have known where to start. eBay not only generated more than 1 million jobs, it also brought livelihoods to people excluded from similar entrepreneurial possibilities. Today, an army of more than 1 million entrepreneurs forms the backbone of eBay, generating more than $60 billion of annual economic activity. These are people like Brandy Tolley from Springfield, Illinois. In 2001, Brandy was a 26-year-old single mom, an Army veteran, whose son had recently been diagnosed with autism. Brandy couldn't hold down a regular job as she had too many medical appointments to go to with her son. eBay gave Brandy an opportunity to start a successful online business selling oversized men's clothing while staying at home to take care of her family. Through eBay, Brandy found customers in 67 countries and in the process made lots of friends and became part of a vibrant, supportive virtual community. Now, what we learn from people like Brandy inspires and informs the work of a Midiard network, a belief that people are inherently capable, that when given access to opportunity, people frequently develop innovative solutions to their own problems, that entrepreneurship and the private sector can be powerful tools for positive change, and that technology is a great way to foster social connections and to quickly spread innovation. After eBay went public in 1998, Pierre and his wife Pam decided to commit much of their wealth to the betterment of society. They first established a traditional foundation focused on distributing money to worthy not-for-profits. But Pierre soon felt he was being asked to participate in a fight with one hand tied behind his back. After all, eBay taught him how the private sector could create social benefit. Yet the very definition and legal structure of foundations seemed to be built on the assumption that for-profits were of no use in driving positive social change. So in 2004, Pierre and Pam established a Midiard network as a new type of philanthropy, a philanthropic investment firm, marrying the social good focus of the not-for-profit sector with the market incentives and drive for scale of the for-profit sector. At Midiard Network, we invest in and help scale up entrepreneurial ventures that each have the potential to create opportunity for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. We believe that creating opportunity for individuals enables them to improve the quality of their lives, the lives of their family, community, and ultimately creates a more fair and prosperous society. Now, at the very heart of our strategy is a flexible approach to philanthropy. We embrace whatever tools necessary, including not-for-profit grants and for-profit investments, to support high-impact social entrepreneurs and the broader environments in which they work. Our hybrid investment approach is supported by a hybrid organization structure. We operate both a foundation and a for-profit investment fund under one roof. My goal this evening, however, is not actually to focus on the specifics of our particular model. It's rather to convince you of a broader point. It's to illustrate the importance of finding hybrid solutions to pressing social problems. In the past years, we've witnessed a counterproductive and sometimes bitter debate among social change practitioners. In one corner of this intellectual boxing ring are those who boldly assert that the private sector and unfettered markets will solve all our problems, and that grants merely breed inefficiency and dependency. In the other corner are those who argue that the profit motive itself is the root of many of society's ills, and that the private sector does not have viable solutions. Charitable grants, untarnished by the profit motive, they insist, are the morally acceptable way to address society's ills. Now, if there's any message I'd like to leave with you tonight, it's that we need to avoid the straitjacket of this either-or thinking and embrace the power of and. Both grants and investments are critical for progress. To make these arguments real and tangible, I'll highlight a few stories that demonstrate the value of for-profit social ventures. I'll then share similar stories that illustrate the value of not-for-profit social ventures. Finally, I'll bring these threads together and show how the two approaches can be complementary, how for-profits and not-for-profits can work side by side to create, nurture, and scale up entire new sectors that improve the lives of millions. So let's start with one cross-section of the billions of people who could benefit from more access to opportunity. School children in Kenya. The Kenyan public school system is in shambles. Illiteracy is off the charts. Teachers show up only about half the time, and even then rarely hold class. In an entire day, by some accounts, the average time dedicated to instruction is 90 minutes. And free public school education is actually not free. Parents pay for school uniforms, books and supplies, lunch. Worse, they're often forced to bribe officials and school teachers just to get them to do their jobs. A few years ago, Midyar Network invested in Bridge International Academies, an ultra-low-cost chain of primary schools that we think can transform the education sector in Kenya. Bridge was founded by Jay Kimmelman, Shannon May, and Phil Fry. Now, Jay's a tech entrepreneur from the Bay Area who started and sold a successful educational software company called Edusoft. Motivated to put his business skills to work for social good, Jay and his team spent several years researching scalable solutions to poverty. It was in the slums of Nairobi that Jay and his team began to implement the idea of a school in a box, essentially a franchise model of schools providing standardized, high-quality educational services that could be easily and quickly replicated for poor communities. Notably, Bridge International is a for-profit company, and yet, because it's been able to create economies of scale, Bridge offers its students a vastly superior education for less than, get this, $4 a month, when we all love to have tuition like that. This is about the same cost as a public school. Bridge students get about 45 hours of instruction per week, compared to less than 10 hours per week at a public school. Despite living in incredibly tough environments, Bridge students are already academically dramatically outperforming their peers from much wealthier neighborhoods. Jay's model is getting great traction. Bridge already serves 2,700 students in 22 schools, making it perhaps surprisingly the largest chain of private schools in Africa. They expect to have 100 schools at this time next year, and by 2018, they expect to have more than 3,000 schools serving more than 2.5 million students. Jay's vision is nothing short of transforming education not only in Kenya, but in the entire developing world. And I've been to a Bridge school, and I think Jay's got a good shot. Another inspiring example of one of our for-profit investees delivering great social impact is D-Lite, a business that manufactures and distributes ultra-low-cost solar-powered lamps designed for people living in extreme poverty. Many don't know, but one out of four families in the world lives without electricity. And you've seen those pictures from the sky of various parts of the world at night. There's vast parts of the globe that simply are not lit up. People don't have access to electricity and light. Now, school children in these families can't do their homework at night because they don't have any light. Or if they do have light, they use kerosene lamps, which are expensive and dangerous. Every time a child uses a kerosene lamp, it releases fumes equivalent to smoking 2 packs of cigarettes. Kerosene lamps also cause accidental fires. It's estimated that more than 2.5 million people in the developing world suffer from severe burns every year, and most of those burns are a result of overturned kerosene lamps. D-Lite solar lights are much cheaper than kerosene, don't emit toxins, and virtually eliminate the risk of fire. With these lights, 13-year-olds like Monica Singh in Uttar Pradesh, India, are able to make simple but really important decisions that you and I and our children take for granted. Monica may think, it's late, I'm tired. Maybe I'll go to sleep now, but I'll wake up really early, turn on the light, and do my homework then. These decisions can have enormous consequences. It's a difference that allows a driven student like Monica to study longer, improve her grades, and maybe even go to university. It's a difference that might mean Monica can become a scientist, a doctor, or even, why not, a head of state. D-Lite has already illuminated more than 3 million lives and is poised for exponential growth. Both D-Lite and Bridge are for-profit businesses, but don't get the wrong idea. At Omidyar Network, our goal is to marry the best of the for-profit and not-for-profit worlds, which means that we use grants as well as commercial investments to support innovative social entrepreneurs. In fact, of the $400 million, yes, that's right, $400 million of philanthropic capital to date that we've deployed, about 44% has supported equity investments, but 56%, the majority, has actually supported grants. So here's how we think about the different roles of for-profit investments and grants. Now, for-profit investments leverage the power of markets to generate positive social impact. By definition, for-profit companies like Bridge and D-Lite have to offer a product or service that people are willing to pay for at a price above the company's costs. In essence, the success of a business is determined by its ability to cost-effectively deliver value to the individual, and by definition, therefore, value to society. If unable to do this, a business will simply fail. If successful, however, a business can generate an income stream that enables it to become sustainable over time. These profits and access to financing from capital markets, debt, equity, help businesses grow fast and scale up, delivering valuable products and services to millions. And this is just the kind of scale that we need to address today's most pressing problems. To give you a sense of the ability of businesses to scale, since 1970, tens of thousands of for-profit businesses have grown from zero to more than $50 million in annual revenue. And in that same period, only 144 not-for-profits have gone from zero to $50 million. Of course, while efficient, markets and for-profit companies have obvious limitations in this social change game. Most importantly, I think it's really necessary to understand that what's profitable is not always what's fair and most beneficial to society. Now, while investments in for-profit companies leverage the power of markets to achieve impact, grants to not-for-profits achieve impact by addressing the weaknesses of markets. Whereas businesses deliver value to people who can afford their products and services, grants frequently help disadvantaged populations. Grants also can help provide public goods, such as clean air or libraries, that benefit society collectively. Grants are effective tools in subsidizing the creation of goods and services, such as vaccines, that benefit society as well as the individual. That is, goods that economists call that have what economists call positive externalities. And grants can kickstart entire new markets where early stage business opportunities are simply too risky for profit seeking investors. But grants too have limitations. As I noted, they don't necessarily scale as rapidly as for profit enterprises. And for-profit enterprises know they are delivering value based on a customer's willingness to pay. No such market mechanism really exists for not-for-profits, given that they tend to charge far less than it costs for them to produce a product, or more likely, they don't charge at all. As a result, it's difficult for a not-for-profit to assess what value it's delivering to its customers or to society. Still, grant-based philanthropy has done tremendous good in the world. Thank goodness for Andrew Carnegie and the public libraries he funded, bringing books and enlightenment to millions. Thank goodness for the Rockefeller Foundation's contributions to the Green Revolution, which benefited hundreds of millions through dramatic increases in agricultural productivity in the developing world. And thank goodness for the pioneering work on vaccines spearheaded by the Gates Foundation and others. Wario Kolo, one of the co-founders of the not-for-profit Ushahidi, is a great example of the inspiring social entrepreneurs that we have supported with grants. Ori grew up in a poor family in Kenya. Her parents could barely afford to send her to primary school. Her father died when she was a young adult. Through sheer determination, Ori gained entrance to college and later to Harvard Law School, after which she returned to Kenya to contribute to the development of the young democracy. Now, in 2007, the contested presidential election in Kenya precipitated widespread violence, as you may recall. In response, Ori helped create Ushahidi, which is the Swahili word for testimony. You can ask your friends that one tonight. Which is a crowdsourcing website that collected and recorded eyewitness reports of violence using text messages combined with Google Maps. Virtually overnight, the website was used by more than 45,000 people to track negative incidents and to create effective interventions. This Ushahidi technology has since been used more than 15,000 times on dozens of applications around the world. Just hours after the recent devastating earthquake and tsunami in Japan, activists used Ushahidi to map and better coordinate relief efforts. In Libya, Ushahidi has been critical in helping the UN, the Red Cross, and others more effectively help embattled citizens. Indeed, Ushahidi is at the very cutting edge of a wave of tech-based innovations that are shaping social and political interactions around the world. Ushahidi is but one of a number of high-impact, not-for-profit entrepreneurial ventures that we've supported. Other examples, and you may recognize a few, include Janagraha, an Indian organization which seeks to reduce petty corruption by encouraging individuals to draw attention to bribe-paying incidents through a public site called ipaydaybribe.com. And Refugees United, an online search tool that allows refugees to trace missing family members and reunite with loved ones. Sometimes we forget there are more than 45 million people in this world who are displaced persons, and a lot of them are divided from their families, and Refugees United has developed this wonderful tool to enable them to find each other. Though diverse, all of our grant recipients, whether the goal is enhancing government transparency or reuniting families, are creating public goods, they're helping disadvantaged populations, or they're catalyzing new markets. Well, at this point, I've used examples to describe you the merits of both for-profit investments and grants in driving positive social change. So what is exactly new here? Philanthropists have been making grants to nonprofit organizations for centuries. There are also an increasing number of so-called impact investors who are investing in businesses that they believe can generate both financial and social returns. What is actually highly unusual is that we do both nonprofit and for-profit investments in the same house with the same staff, and we dedicate nearly equal resources to both. We're organized that way because we know that effective social change is not an either-or proposition. Sometimes for-profit solutions are the answer. Sometimes nonprofit solutions are the answer. And sometimes, very often, the most effective solution is actually the right combination of both. Now, this assertion that for-profit and not-for-profit investments can be complementary is not just some abstract theory. It's playing out in important ways around the world today. A recent study by the Monitor Group, for example, concluded that most of the organizations that have had the biggest impact, the biggest positive impact on the poor in India, are actually for-profit companies. They also noted, however, that most, if not all, of these for-profit companies received grants or other forms of soft funding in their early startup phases. So again, it's not an either-or. It's an and. Perhaps more exciting, moving even beyond the Monitor work, is what we see when we zoom out and focus on the bigger picture. Specifically, we're discovering that a thoughtful and complementary blend of early-stage for-profit and not-for-profit investments can move forward entire sectors. To us, this is the holy grail. Not only supporting high-impact social entrepreneurs who can touch thousands of lives, but nurturing and growing entire sectors that can touch hundreds of millions or even billions of lives in a positive way. The field of microfinance is perhaps the best illustration of how hybrid approaches can achieve such large-scale impact. The phenomenal growth of many of you have heard of microfinance, the industry built on the premise that the poor are indeed creditworthy and should have access to capital, just as we do, to improve the quality of their lives. You've heard the wonderful stories of poor women who borrow a modest sum, buy a cow, start a dairy, and are able to generate the income to send their children to school and to change the trajectory of their children's lives. The phenomenal growth of microfinance really illustrates how a complementary mix of grants and for-profit investments can first nurture and then accelerate market growth. So, for example, in the 1980s and 90s, most microfinance institutions, or MFIs, were grant-funded NGOs. As the size and commercial viability of the microfinance sector became apparent, commercial investors, many of whom had a strong social motivation, invested heavily in rapidly growing MFIs. Commercial MFIs, which had access to capital, expanded much more rapidly than their capital-constrained nonprofit brethren. As recently as 1998, only 22% of the largest 50 MFIs were registered for-profit banks. 10 years later, by 2008, 62% were for-profit registered banks. In other words, grant capital sparked and nurtured at microfinance, and for-profit capital helped take it to scale. Now, Omidyar Network has consistently applied a flexible philanthropy approach to microfinance. We've been very active in this space for many years, and we've sought to catalyze the sector with a mix of for-profit and not-for-profit investments. Since 2004, we've invested more than $100 million in microfinance across 28 organizations, 15 not-for-profits and 13 for-profits. We recognize, of course, that microfinance has come under increasing scrutiny. Among other things, it appears that MFIs have paid insufficient attention to consumer protection and consumer education. Government oversight has sometimes been inadequate and other times simply been overbearing. Competition has not always been sufficient to drive up quality and drive down costs. But it's critical not to forget how much good microfinance has accomplished. Because of microfinance, 150 million people now have access to capital who otherwise would not have. 150 million people, most of whom live on less than a dollar a day, can now decide to start dairy farms or corner stores, generating the income necessary to send their children to school and eventually break the cycle of poverty. Of course, the success of a hybrid approach in creating markets, and creating markets particularly in microfinance, begs a question. Was the microfinance experience unique? Is this just a one-off? Or can it be replicated? Can we really use hybrid approaches to develop other market sectors that benefit the underprivileged? Well, as you might suspect, we believe the answer is yes. Otherwise, I'd have to end the speech right now. Late last year, we commissioned the management consulting firm of McKinsey & Company to look at new solutions to improving the lives of the poor in India through innovations in medtech and clean energy. The potential for social impact, it appears, is absolutely enormous in the hundreds of millions of lives for both sectors. The market opportunity in the billions of dollars is also quite promising. And after thorough examination, McKinsey concluded that the best path towards developing these sectors is similar to what we saw in microfinance, a thoughtful mix of grant capital to create required industry infrastructure and reduce risks, and large-scale commercial capital to bring potential life-changing innovations to scale. Now, though incredibly impactful, this mixing of grant capital and investments raises really important questions that we continue to wrestle with, such as, how does one determine which sectors should receive this scarce grant capital? Why microfinance? Why clean energy? How does one ensure that grant capital does not constrain the creation of a viable for-profit business? If you're subsidizing, are you subsidizing the right things? Or are you subsidizing in a way that will hold back the market? And is it appropriate for businesses to benefit financially from early grant funding coming from philanthropists or others? And perhaps most pressing, where can we find socially motivated investors who are willing to make high-risk bets early on early-stage businesses? On this last question, it's worth noting that a giant pool of capital that cares deeply about social change, U.S. foundations, is largely sitting on the sidelines of the early-stage investment game. It's a little-known fact that U.S. foundations are allowed to make investments in for-profit businesses that serve a social mission. Currently, a few pioneering foundations, such as Skoll, Rockefeller, and Gates, are beginning to take advantage of this capability. The vast majority, however, are not. In fact, of the $44 billion in capital deployed by foundations in 2007, 99% went to grants. Only 5/100ths, that's right, 5/100ths of 1%, or a mere $20 million out of that $44 billion, went to equity-based for-profit investments. Now, scratch beneath the surface here, and you'll discover that part of the obstacle is simply perception. Equity investments are seen as too risky because you can actually lose some of your principal. It's important to remember, however, that when you make a grant, you are giving the money away. In other words, you will lose 100% of your principal. Guaranteed. This is just one example of how re-examining our assumptions in favor of flexible philanthropy could make a tremendous difference. Another really interesting statistic for you. If U.S. foundations invested just 5% of their endowment, which is about $560 billion, into for-profit social businesses that aim to serve the underprivileged, they'd free up a pool of capital that amounts to $29 billion. $1 billion. This sum, to put it in perspective, is larger than what the entire U.S. venture capital industry invests in startup businesses in a typical year. Now, let's pause to think about this for just a moment. In just a few decades, the U.S. venture capital market has spurred technological innovations that have dramatically changed the lives of billions around the world. A full 21% of U.S. GDP is created by early-stage venture-backed startups. Now, imagine what we could do with a similar sum of capital deployed for the purpose of positive social change. It's easy to get lost in the details here and lose sight of the bigger picture. I've described Omidyar Network's approach to social change, but this is actually not about Omidyar Network. Indeed, we're still early in our journey, and we've a lot to learn from our peers in the philanthropic sector. What we're really talking about is something much larger than Omidyar Network and much larger than any of these stories that I've shared with you this evening. Ultimately, it's about the movement to break down artificial and unnecessary boundaries between nonprofit and for-profit sectors so we can get more quickly to effective solutions. And it's about a vision of philanthropy that's not just about charity and not just about business, but about what really works. The broader point here is that we have so much to gain by looking beyond our own silos to find hybrid strategies with the biggest impact. Now, overcoming the prejudices that divide the nonprofit and for-profit sectors won't be easy. Just last week, a woman working in the social sector described to me the attitude she encountered when trying to make a career move from the private sector to the social sector. The first question she was asked when interviewing for a job at a very prominent foundation was, "Why have you decided to move from the greed side to the good side?" These stereotypes work both ways. When I run into former colleagues and tell them that I work in philanthropy, I occasionally get asked if this means that I have retired. Well, my wonderful wife is sitting in the audience today, and she can assure you that this is absolutely not the case. These prejudices suggest that we're focusing on the wrong questions. Instead of arguing which side is better or has the right solution, we should be carefully examining when and how to capitalize on our respective strengths. There is much urgent work to be done. But I, for one, am very optimistic. I'm optimistic because of people like Jay Kimmelman and his team in Kenya, who are managing a network of schools that allow young people to take control of their own future. And I'm optimistic because of the millions of people we haven't named, such as the courageous mothers in Bangladesh who take out loans to start corner stores that can change their children's future. What we've seen time and time again is that when you give people access to opportunity, you unlock their drive and creativity to find their own solutions. And the answers they come up with are often incredibly inspiring. Our job is to harness this entrepreneurial talent for social good. When we're able to use all the resources we have available, for profit, nonprofit, and every possible combination of the two, it is then that we have the best chance to create opportunity for millions and to solve the world's most intractable problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt, for a great talk. And I didn't put this here so that you can think that it's a done deal. I put it here so you can't see the questions.
Ruth was actually really worried that I was stealing sideways glances as going through the speech.
This is quite a system I've got here. Okay. So throughout the series, one of the key themes has been, and in the world of social entrepreneurship, has been this blurring of the demarcation between profit and for-profit. And so it's very appropriate that your talk, in effect, ends the discussion because that's a demarcation that Omidyar Network is seeking to bridge. But it's early days, And there's a lot of questions around how to do that bridging. So let's dig in a little bit about that discussion. You talked a lot about microfinance. We know that in India, some of the people who are running microfinance organizations have themselves become extremely wealthy, and some of those organizations have had multi-million dollar IPOs. So if for-profit social change organizations are okay, are there certain rules of the game about what's acceptable and what's not?
Yeah, I mean, it was the situation in India is quite interesting, and it's always interesting not just to see what's going on the ground, but to read the debate and what kind of issues people focus on. And one of the issues that, in my view, got very little attention is the role of government. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that gets lost in the mix. People either say it's all business and business is going to do good or it's going to do ill. But government really has an important role to play in creating the rules of the road, and I think very importantly, ensuring that there's adequate competition. Because study after study after study in microfinance has said that the best way to drive the cost of the borrower down, right, and drive the quality of your services up is to have great competition. And unfortunately, in a number of environments, that competition actually has not been sufficiently robust to get very positive momentum going. The other thing that was missing in India is the consumer protection and consumer education. And there's some basic, again, foundational things in the sector we're missing, such as a credit bureau. There's no credit bureau in India, so banks couldn't tell whether a borrower had already borrowed from one, two, or three other MFIs.
Right.
So there's some basic infrastructural things. I think if people would focus on those issues, I mean, one of the problems in India is not just that you had a few people making money, but that it was seen as unfair and borrowers were seen ultimately as not benefiting as they should. So I think if you can address those structural issues, those are the really most important issues to address.
But if you go into a place where there's no other microfinance organization, for example, shouldn't you then start off as a nonprofit because you're the only game in town? And I mean, by definition, the leader has a monopoly until someone else comes in.
But if the leader is successful, others will come in,
right?
And if the leader is not successful, it proves perhaps there's not a market, and maybe that's where government needs to play a more active role.
Okay. There's a number of questions about impact investing that we'll get to, but let me just ask you, when Omidyar Network invests in for-profit entities, what kinds of returns are you looking for? And, I mean, is it across the board, or do you have certain parameters that you're looking for?
Yeah. So our process in doing for-profit investments is that we look first for companies that drive significant positive social impact. That's the screen, right? Because there's a range of the level of positive social impact that any company will deliver, and we tend to only invest in companies that we think can have a fabulous positive social impact. And then we would apply the typical standard financial analysis that you would to determine whether a business is going to be successful. And our experience is that almost all of these businesses are people who are socially motivated, but also who are very much driven to scale the business up, and that means in part generating the returns that will help them to get the capital to grow bigger and faster and have a bigger impact.
Okay. So you're not saying I'll give you 5% or 10% or I'm looking for a particular. You're looking for programmatic, structural.
We're looking for big, very big, large positive social impact.
Right.
Well-run entrepreneurs. And we do take more risk probably than other investors would take. So, for example, Bridge Academy is doing fabulously well now.
Right.
We invest at very, very early stage, and 5% will, not to get too technical, but the risk-free rate on government bonds in Kenya must be in the 30-50%,
right?
So we aren't going in expecting 100 or 200% return on Bridge. It's not realistic, actually. If you were to ask a typical venture capitalist what their required rate would be, of going into the slums of Nairobi to build schools? Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, they wouldn't look at it, right? And second of all, if they did look at it and looked at the numbers we were looking at, it's not clear that they would invest. So we have a high risk tolerance. So social impact, disciplined financial analysis, but also with a high tolerance for risk in terms of what we're willing to take to have that positive social impact.
Now, when banks take on a lot of risk, they price for that risk. Do you price for that risk? Do you ask for higher interest rates for the for-profit?
So the interest rate would come in if we were doing debt financing.
Right.
And we actually don't do debt financing. Or you know, I have a few of my colleagues who remember years back who go back to the office and say, remember when we did that in 2008? But we don't do much debt financing. So it's primarily equity. And equity, you're not sure what the return's going to be.
Right.
You're hopeful that you get a decent return, but you actually don't know.
Now, Matt, you spoke a lot about scale. And that's a term that's used quite often in the whole discourse on social entrepreneurship. And I have found that throughout these conversations, there is a difference between scale and systemic change. What would you say that there is a difference between them? And what, if so, what is that? And are you looking for scale or are you looking for systemic change?
Both, mm-hmm. right? So back up a little bit and say we look for impact, right? And how we think about impact is how many people you reach and the depth of change that you're able to help create in their lives. Mm-hmm. So we say reach times engagement. So reach how many people times the level of engagement equals impact. So that is how we think about it. So scale is one element, right? Scale is reach.
Right.
And then we look at the depth of impact. So whether somebody is getting education with Bridge or a light with D-Light, those are different types of impact that you need to think about a little bit differently.
Right.
Now, in terms of systemic change, that is I think critically important. Our approach is to find the social entrepreneurs who are working in areas that we're interested in, who we think have the opportunity to have that impact, right, scale, reach times engagement. But we're also looking at creating a network of these entrepreneurs, hence the name, right, the Omidyar Network. The notion isn't just investing in individual entrepreneurs, but then bringing them together as a network so that the whole is much more impactful than simply the sum. So when we create that network, we're also looking at how do you create systemic change within that network? And a lot of the times that's investing behind yet another social entrepreneur, and a lot of the times that's investing in specific elements of what we would call infrastructure to move the whole sector forward.
Getting back to your comment about microfinance, you said that government is often overlooked in all of this, and I agree. And I could argue that government is an integral partner in systemic change.
Yes.
Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So do you work with government? And if so, how?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in dialogue with governments in the major geographies in which we work. And specifically in the U.S., we're in pretty consistent dialogue with the State Department, for example, on the work we're doing, and that they're incredibly excited about this whole realm of technology for government transparency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen with what's going on in the Middle East, and we've seen it elsewhere as well, that technology has a really important, if somewhat unpredictable, role to play in social change, and in particular in this realm of government transparency. So we're doing a lot of work on government transparency that is of significant interest to the State Department. So we have a number of contacts there. Also, the State Department's very interested in entrepreneurship in the developing world. So that too is an area of collaboration.
So I need to just segue for a point since you brought this up. I just want you to give a quick answer to this question. If that's the case, one of our audience members wants to know, why did PayPal terminate the WikiLeaks accounts?
Yeah, PayPal is Omidyar Network is a completely
right.
separate entity that has absolutely no influence or bearing on
that
okay. PayPal decision.
All right. Well, then I asked that question, and we can move on. All right. Another big discussion topic in all of this is the notion of measurement. Mm-hmm. And many argue that by bringing business rigor into philanthropy and into nonprofit management, you bring in the notion of measurement and return on investment in a way that has not historically been present. How does ON measure what you're doing? And if it's not a return in terms of amounts for the for-profit, what is it, and how do you measure for the nonprofit, or is it are there measurements across both sides?
Yeah, first of all, I'd start off and say that a lot of the foundations have done a much better job on measurement than they're given credit for, because fundamentally it's really difficult to measure the outcomes of some of the things that they do, and I think given that, they've actually done quite a nice job. The way we think about measurement is somewhat different in the private sector and with our for-profit investments and our not-for-profit investments. Now, the similarity underneath both of them is we try and come back to this notion of reach and engagement. So whether it's nonprofit or for-profit, it's how many lives did you impact or reach, and what was the depth of that impact, right? Right. And so we use that framework for both for-profit and not-for-profit investments. For the for-profit investments, you have the additional metrics, of course, of financial return.
Right.
And typically, it's interesting because most of the for-profits we invest in are already capturing the metrics that we care about from a social impact perspective, right? So eBay is an example. eBay, the financial success, you can look at the returns there and the share price, what have you. But you also, as a critical part, having been inside eBay, is the notion of how many people are active on the platform. How many sellers are there? How successful have the sellers been? So a typical well-run business will have a number of metrics that are not just financial metrics, but give the business a sense of how positive an impact they're having on the lives of their customers.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about the notion that first quote that you gave. You can probably recite it off the top of your head. That's on the wall when you walk into a media network.
Every individual has the power to make a difference.
Right. And early in the series, we had Bill Drayton, who runs Ashoka, and his phrase is, everyone a change maker.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense among a number of people that the notion of social entrepreneurship is an elite notion. Mm-hmm. And that there's a number, you know, Harvard Business School, Stanford Business School, Wharton, they're all teaching social entrepreneurship. But if you get into poor neighborhoods in the United States, in Europe, in developing countries, those people are just focused on entrepreneurship. Is that true, or do you need to make money before you can do social good, or can you be doing it right from the beginning?
Well, of course, it's a very easy one. I think we all can be change makers each and every day of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as citizens and as parents, I think it's really important that we send that message to our kids as well and encourage them to do things that actively engage them in the lives of others and helping others. And I think we also need to model that as parents, absolutely. And I think it's never too young. There are things that our kids in high school are doing now that really give them a sense of being connected to a broader connected to and accountable to a broader community. So I think everybody could be active every day and frankly should be.
And maybe we can just dig down. I'm the mother of teenage kids applying to college. And there is this almost this pressure on our kids to have invented something, to have started a nonprofit by the time they're 16, that they can put it, you know, to go out and do service. I mean, what are some ways that young people can get involved without actually starting their own nonprofit organization by the time they're 16?
Yeah. It's a great point, Ruth, and I don't pretend to have the answer to the college admissions process.
Well, I mean that there's
our daughter went through the same process, and two sons will come along here shortly. It was interesting, though, in my daughter's case, if I can take that one, I think there it is important not just to run something, but to be active and to show that interest and, you know, sustained activity over a period of time. I mean, that's when you really get the advantage. I think there's another dynamic which is unfortunate sometimes in the whole process is kids feel they're checking a box.
Right.
Right. And so to the extent that colleges emphasize it, it's okay, I got to check this box. What we really need to do is focus on ensuring that the kids really understand why they're doing that and value that kind of work. And then hopefully the college admissions process kind of learns along the way.
Well, I use that to get to a bigger question, but first let me take a moment to remind our radio audience that we're talking with Matt Bannick, the managing partner of OMIDIAR Network, and this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Kids getting into college is one issue, but the question is, if everyone needs to be involved, how can everyone be involved? Not everyone needs to start an organization. So in your worldview, is it important to spend time working for someone else first, important to be doing nonprofit work? What is the way that everyone can be involved?
I think there's so many ways, Ruth. I mean, in each of our communities, I think we can look to multiple ways we can get involved. I think it's up to us as parents to do so. I do think there is this emphasis on sometimes on the, and maybe this is one of the points you were getting at, the social entrepreneur as hero, mm-hmm. who's going to change the whole world.
Right.
And you look, for example, at the CNN Heroes program, and some of those people are doing such amazing things. But one of the things I like about the program is there are a lot of people who are just doing things that are within their capabilities that aren't necessarily changing the world, but are changing their little corner of the world and reaching and touching one person at a time. So in as much as we talk about scale, the word scale can be so distancing and impersonal, mm-hmm. and sometimes not as rewarding as that one-on-one connection that you can make.
Right.
So I think that sometimes we can get lost in our language, you know, as people who care about the betterment of society. And sometimes it's really important to ground ourselves in that one-on-one relationship, right, and helping our society, engaging with somebody in need or somebody you can help at any given point. And you can do that at any age, at any time. We just have to reach out.
Well, I think that a number of the social entrepreneurs that have spoken here have emphasized their need to really utilize the resources of other organizations in addition to their own, and that to truly be effective, you need to utilize, to realize what the resources are everywhere,
yeah.
and leverage them.
Yeah.
And I think it sounds like that's what you're trying to do by creating this ecosystem of organizations addressing a common issue. Is that a fair paraphrase?
Yeah. So here's how we think about it. Right. We'll look at an area like technology for government transparency or clean energy in India that is nascent, and we'll say, okay, what needs to be done to get from here to here? And part of the solution is creating the environment or the infrastructure, I might say, in which social entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs can flourish, right? Mm-hmm. So you will make various bets, various investments in sort of that infrastructure. And then you can make investments at each of the individual entrepreneurs who themselves can leverage that infrastructure to be more successful. So it's both. Our eye is always on the sector level. And then the primary vehicle for change is investing in the individual entrepreneur.
Okay. Let's talk about impact investing and social investing and for-profit B corporations and a number of these different types of interventions or mechanisms to provide capital to do social good. Mm-hmm. Where do you see these hybrid organizations? Where would you like to see them go in terms of, well, how big do you want them to be and what do you think are the most promising?
Yeah, I think, as you noted, we are in an era now where there is more experimentation,
mm-hmm.
And with things like impact investing. I think we should continue to be open to look at the solutions that are working. I mean, it's just like we're close to the Valley here. One of the hallmarks of success in the Valley is to try a lot of things.
Right.
And figure out which ones don't work and shut them down, right? And figure out which ones do work and put more resources behind them. And so we're now in an era, I think, of a lot of experimentation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the social sector is not so disciplined in shutting down experiments that don't work. Right. And for good reason, there are frequently lives who are dependent upon those programs. But I think we have to have a more disciplined approach and lots of experimentation, shut down the things that don't work, and then really figure out a way to kind of scale up the things that do work.
Okay, well, let's go from there, because in its short history, Omidyar Network has tried a number of different strategies. Mm-hmm. What are some of the ahas that you figured out that don't work? What are the lessons learned so far?
Mm-hmm. So one of the first ahas, lessons learned, was what I outlined in the speech, which is when Pierre and Pam started out with a traditional foundation and felt really constrained by that as a mechanism for social change. So that was kind of an early lesson learned. I think we're also learning how we can evaluate grants and for-profit investments side by side, because it's tricky. And one of the things you really have to understand is the various incentives that are in place and how do you structure it. And frankly, for a while, I think we were frankly a little easier on doing grants than we were on doing investments. Mm-hmm. Because investments, we had so many financial metrics that we could look at and drill down into. Grants, somehow, there weren't as many. And so grants became easier to do, sort of. And we found ourselves going away from our 50-50 balance, which was where we'd like to be, to doing a lot more grants. And we've sort of had to bring that back to the middle. And so we've made our fair share of mistakes. And again, the important thing is you kind of learn from those. And one of the things I think we also can do a better job is learning from those and then sharing what we've learned, because I think that's equally important.
Maybe you could just talk for a minute about how Omidyar Network finds its investments, whatever side they're on. Mm-hmm. What's your search? I mean, are you just seeking proposals, or are you going out and looking?
You know, here again, I think we'd be very similar to your typical venture capitalist in the Valley here. Mm-hmm. We tend to hire and develop people who have pretty deep domain expertise in the areas that we're interested in. And they nurture and develop their network. Get to know the other people who are investing in that area. They get to know the sector really well. And eventually they're sufficiently plugged in such that when something really interesting is happening, either they're aware of it because they already know the entrepreneur, or it's brought to them. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, kind of the deal sourcing, if we can call it that, is very similar to what you'd find in the venture capital world. And it also works for nonprofits as well.
But that deal sourcing requires a really ability to have your ear to the ground wherever you are.
Absolutely. Right? And we have experts in the field. And by the way, once we make an investment, once we make a grant, for instance, we're different in how we go about that, because we invest in the entrepreneur. A lot of foundations will develop a strategy and will invest in a piece of an entrepreneur's mm-hmm. operations. Okay. We tend to find an entrepreneur and buy into their vision, right? And we therefore tend to provide what's called general operating support, which is to say, this is a grant, and you, the entrepreneur, you know best how to seize the opportunities that you see. You know how best to deploy that capital. The other thing we do is we provide what we call human capital as well. We have a 3 or 4 full-time team of recruiters who help build executive teams for not-for-profits primarily. Mm-hmm. And we also work closely with our grantees to help them on issues of strategy and marketing and those sorts of things as well. So we're pretty deeply committed to their success.
Okay. And let me just ask, we have time for just one more question. Do you bring all your investees together in a way that they can be working with each other, or are you always the hub?
Yes, well, we do bring them together. Uh-huh. And in fact, just a couple months ago, I was at a ON Hot village celebration or gathering of our investees in India. Uh-huh. We brought them all together, and it's actually quite remarkable to see many of them knew each other, many uh-huh. of them did not. And there were a lot of connections being made. And in fact, in subsequent weeks, we heard of a lot of potential partnerships that were nurtured in those conversations. Similarly, we have a couple months from now here in the Valley, we have what we call the UN Executive Forum, where we bring in the CEOs of the organizations, for-profit and not-for-profit, and they spend time together. And this will be the second year we've done it, and last year they found it incredibly valuable. We like to think that they found the content we provided valuable, and they did. But even more valuable for them was actually spending time with each other and learning from each other. So it's actually incredibly powerful to bring them together so that they can share ideas and meet with other entrepreneurs and help each other build their respective organizations.
I agree. Okay, our thanks to Matt Bannock. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program is the last in the series on social entrepreneurship in America. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.